Thanks, Nancy. What I thought I would talk about today and sort of divide it up into three parts is kind of the birth of fear of vaccines, which I think happened on a specific day. Actually, it celebrated its 28th anniversary yesterday. And then I want to talk about, I think, the ability to act on that fear, which is kind of the history of religious and philosophical exemptions in the United States. And then briefly about the consequences of that fear, although I think Saad will really address that far more than I will. So the birth of fear, it was associated with the fear of the whole cell pertussis vaccine in 1982. On April 19th of that year, there was a film that was aired on a local DC NBC affiliate called WRC-TV4. It was called DPT Vaccine Roulette. Lee Thompson was the writer, she was the producer, and she was the host of the show. And what it showed was, I don't know if any of you were old enough to remember, it's just curious, how many remember DPT Vaccine Roulette? Yes, so some of you do. It was, it showed a series of children who had received the whole cell pertussis vaccine, and then within a few days had become either developed a seizure disorder, and then within the first year of life had a permanent seizure disorder, epilepsy, as well as mental retardation. And it was really a striking film. You saw sort of up close in almost painful detail children who were seizing, who had withered limbs, or spastic limbs, who were drooling. And the parents told a compelling story. My child was fine, then they got this pertussis vaccine, and then they weren't fine anymore. Now, there were a few people in the D.C. area who were watching that show, Barbara Lowe Fisher, Kathy Williams, and Jeff Schwartz. And within really a week or so, they had found each other, frankly, through WRC-TV4 in D.C., through Lee Thompson. And they formed a group that was called Dissatisfied Parents Together, which in the early 1990s changed its name to the National Vaccine Information Center, I think the premier anti-vaccine group in the United States. Interestingly, within only 1 month of that show airing on WRC, and actually very quickly it was cut up into segments, and it was shown on the Today Show, where it had not only a local impact but a national impact. Paula Hawkins, who was a Republican congressman from Florida, held a congressional hearing to discuss vaccine safety, and it was off to the races. I think once that happened, between that show and that congressional hearing, was born the notion that the whole cell pertussis vaccine could permanently disable children. The media coverage ultimately led to, I think, what were a flood of lawsuits, successfully claiming that the pertussis vaccine caused sudden infant death syndrome, RISE syndrome, coma, mental retardation and epilepsy, as well as transverse myelitis. And frankly, it brought the pharmaceutical industry to their knees. The price of the DTP vaccine rose from 19 cents a dose in 1980 to $12 a dose in 1986. 95% of that increase was to cover the cost of settlements and awards associated with litigation against the pertussis vaccine. In addition, the number of oral polio vaccine makers declined from 3 to 1, of measles vaccine makers from 6 to 1, and of pertussis vaccine makers from 8 to 1. And as a consequence, as the government was watching essentially companies starting to abandon vaccine manufacturing for American children, the government stepped in, and in 1986 created something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which contains the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which we know today. So it's been around for over 20 years. And the National Vaccine Information Center, which you know was born of the Dissatisfied Parents Together, continues to weigh in on vaccine safety. And basically, their notion is that we have replaced infectious diseases with chronic diseases, and those chronic diseases I'll show you in future slides. But you know, autism, learning disabilities, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, attention deficit disorder, and others. And they're very good at what they do. They're media savvy, they're politically connected, they're personal injury lawyer backed, and they are a formidable group. I mean, you know, I think, you know, journalists will often talk about how brave they are when they take on the CDC or they take on pharmaceutical companies. Those people are wimps. I mean, if you really want to find out how to be brave, take on one of these groups and then watch what happens to your life. And so every time a new vaccine was introduced, the dissatisfied parents together and then National Vaccine Information Center weighed in. So when the HIV vaccine was introduced World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, there was Barbara Lo Fisher with a doctor named Bart Klassen claiming that it caused diabetes. Similarly, World News Tonight again featured Barbara Lo Fisher when the pneumococcal vaccine came out saying that it was a dangerous vaccine and that it could cause seizures. When the hepatitis B vaccine was routinely recommended for newborns in the early 1990s, there was a show on 2020 claiming that the vaccine caused multiple sclerosis and sudden infant death syndrome. Sylvia Chase was the host for that program. When the human papillomavirus vaccine was first brought out in 2006, the NVIC was there claiming that the vaccine caused blood clots, strokes, heart attacks, and chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's a constant drumbeat. I think since their birth, they have constantly been able to get out in front of the media when new vaccines come onto the market or when there are new recommendations for existing vaccines to make their case that they are about to cause chronic permanent damage. Similarly, we moved, as you know, this is just Jenny McCarthy on Oprah. Jenny McCarthy is of the belief, and probably is the celebrity that is the center of the belief, that vaccines cause autism. And that sort of morphed from the MMR vaccine causes autism to thimerosal, an ethylmercury-containing preservative that wasn't in vaccines at preservative levels for young children caused autism, to just the general notion that children are exposed to toxins in vaccines or that children simply get too many vaccines too soon. Jim and Jenny, as you know, have broken up. I think it was a painful day for all of us. Certainly for me, it was a sad day. But sometimes life just doesn't make sense. Okay, so the heart of the talk is acting on it. So now you have fear, and the question is can you act on that fear? And that's really what I want to focus my talk on. So the first question is, do United States citizens have a constitutional right to exempt themselves from vaccines? I mean, how many in the audience believe that it is your constitutional right to not get a vaccine if you don't want to? Raise your hands, don't be scared. And how many believe it is not your constitutional right? Okay, well, you're right, it's not. That actually was born of a case, and this is probably the most important Supreme Court case actually related to this. It was Jacobson v. Massachusetts. It was in 1905. Henning Jacobson was a Lutheran minister in Cambridge, Massachusetts, during a smallpox outbreak that claimed the lives of many Boston citizens. At the time, the Cambridge Board of Health required a smallpox vaccine, or you were fined $5. Henning Jacobson refused both. And therefore, it went initially to local courts, then a state Supreme Court, and ultimately to the United States Supreme Court, where by a vote of 7-2, the decision was made that the state, through its police powers, could compel its citizens to get vaccines. Now, I want to make a distinction, actually, a legal distinction, between a mandatory vaccine and a compulsory vaccine. A mandatory vaccine a compulsory vaccine is when you are pinned down and vaccinated, whether you want to or not. A mandatory vaccine is you are asked to get a vaccine, and if you don't get it, then you suffer some societal cost. In the case of Henning Jacobson, that would have been a $5 fine, or you lose your job, or you can't attend a school. That's a mandatory vaccine. So in any case, speaking for the majority, Justice John Marshall Harlan, in a 7-2 vote, in favor of the state's police powers to compel vaccination, said the liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States does not import an absolute right to be wholly freed from restraint. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. Society based on the rule that each one is a law unto himself would soon be confronted with anarchy and disorder. Now, although there is no constitutional right to refuse vaccines, states may allow exemptions. And initially, there were a number of cases that went to a variety of state courts where basically the petitioners were saying, it is a violation of my First Amendment right that I am being compelled to get a vaccine. And the First Amendment basically says that you have the capacity to practice your religion freely. And they claimed that essentially that it was their religious freedom that should have allowed them to not be vaccinated. But in all these cases, the states ruled against the petitioners, saying that there is no discrimination on the basis of religion because all religions are asked to be vaccinated. There is no discrimination among them. And so in all these cases, the petitioner lost. Now, things changed. A crack was opened in the door on June the 20th, 1966. And it occurred at the New York State Assembly once again proving that bad things come from New York. I mean, it's, you know, the Yankees, you know, as the Philadelphia people in the audience will know, the Mets, for God's sake, right. So, Giants. So what happened on June 20th, 1966 was that there was a bill that was considered by the assemblymen that required polio vaccine for school entry. Now, it passed by a vote of 150-2, but there were two dissenting votes, interestingly, Republicans from Long Island, who believed that because the bill included a provision whereby those whose religion forbade vaccination didn't have to get it, they voted against that bill. And it was actually the direct lobbying efforts of one very powerful religious group in the mid-1960s. Now, because it's specifically stated in this religion's bylaws, if you will, or major text, that vaccination was a bad thing. Now, so I'm going to see if you can guess what religion that is. The Old Testament was written between 1400 and 400 BC, the New Testament between 117 and 138 AD, and the Quran between 610 and 632 AD. None of those three texts predicted the first vaccine, which was Edward Jenner's smallpox vaccine in the late 1700s. So it can't be any of the religions based on any of those three texts. So, anybody have a guess as to what religion is? It would have had to have been a religion founded after 1796. Yeah, I think I heard it, actually. It's Christian Science, which was founded by Mary Baker Eddy in 1875 with her famous book, Science and Faith. And I think the genius of Mary Baker Eddy, actually, was what she was able to do, I think, in the mid-1870s, was sort of put in the hands of the common man the power to heal. Because, you know, medicine didn't have a lot to offer, frankly, in the mid-1870s. And what was offered was often very crude and grim. But she basically believed that illness was a spiritual, not a physical disorder, and diseases should be treated with prayer and not medicines or surgeries. A quote from the book Science and Health is, I may have said Science and Faith before, Science and Health is, "We have smallpox because others have it, but mortal mind, not matter, contains and carries the infection." So if you wanted to avoid smallpox, you would pray. And if you wanted to treat a child with smallpox, you would pray. Now, as I said, there was much that medicine didn't have to offer. This is really Koch's formal postulates for the germ theory weren't, you know, that specific germs can cause specific diseases. It wasn't until 1890. This was before visualization of viruses by electron microscopy, which wasn't until the 1930s. It was before Anisera. The first Anisera was diphtheria-specific Anisera available in 1894. It was before insulin. It was before antibiotics. But in 1966, medicine had a lot to offer. I mean, there was a diphtheria vaccine, a tetanus vaccine, a pertussis vaccine, a polio vaccine, and a measles vaccine, and a polio vaccine initially, Salk's vaccine in 55, Sabin's vaccine in the early 1960s, showed that we could, with vaccination, dramatically reduce the incidence of polio. And so this is actually one of the people who voted against this, Joseph Margiotta. And I'd like to say, it shows you, I think, at some level, the wide berth that we are willing to give religion in this country when we say it's okay if you don't want to get a polio vaccine because you want to pray that your child doesn't get polio or pray that your child gets better when they have polio. I think it's remarkable in that sense how tolerant we are of that notion, which is not to say don't pray, but pray and give antibiotics. I mean, pray and give insulin, pray and give vaccines. And, you know, it's use the brain God gave us. In any case, what Margiotta said was that suppose an exempted child was a polio carrying, and that I have this down there, which I already said. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, there were a series, actually, of outbreaks, but probably the most devastating of which occurred in the Daycroft School in Greenwich, Connecticut, where an outbreak of polio paralyzed 11 children in a school of 128. And as you know, I mean, the paralysis associated with polio really is only the tip of the iceberg of those that are infected. It's probably likely that most of the children in that school were infected with the virus, but asymptomatically. At the time of the outbreak, there hadn't been a single case of polio in Connecticut for more than 3 years. Fortunately, polio didn't spread to the surrounding community because much of the surrounding community was highly vaccinated. In response to that outbreak, there was actually an article written for the New England Journal of Medicine by a public health official who said, quote, "I am deeply bothered that disease prevention measures of documented benefit can be withheld by their parents in the name of religious freedoms, jeopardizing the health of the community as well. The courts of this land have long since set precedent in the protection of children from the irresponsible acts of their parents." This opened the door, though. Now that Christian Science basically, or Christian scientists had said, you know, our religion forbids vaccination, that opened the door. And William Mayer, in the famous case of Mayer v. Besser in 1972, took advantage of that New York State decision, successfully claiming that his First Amendment rights were violated, that basically because he wasn't a Christian scientist, he was being discriminated on the basis of his religion. And that opened a door. The judge basically agreed, and 48 states now have religious exemptions to vaccination. Because the line, I think, between religion and philosophy or personal belief is blurred, there was a famous case of Levy and Scher versus Northport Union School in 1987, where Lou Levy basically argued that, you know, to us, religion is not a temple. Religion is not something outside of ourselves. The judge agreed, saying that vaccine exemptions could be granted if beliefs were held with the strength of religious convictions, even if parents weren't members of religious groups, and now 20 or so states have philosophical exemptions. So the consequences of those three, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because I think Saad will do an excellent job with that. But just as you know, there are outbreaks. Pertussis and measles can occur, certainly among those who haven't been vaccinated because they've chosen not to vaccinate their children, a choice that for some of those children proved certainly of great consequence. And there were three actually Hib deaths in the Philadelphia area, all in parents who had chosen not to vaccinate their children with Hib because they feared the vaccine more than they feared the disease, a choice that proved fatal for their children. This is actually my last slide. I think that what I've gone through, I think, with the history of philosophical and religious exemptions is the voice of the individual. I think that's the voice of the individual saying, look at me, I have rights, these are my rights. But I think what you're starting to see, and it's very encouraging, is you're starting to hear the voice of society, and I think it's presented in three ways. The first is that a number of hospitals now are mandating influenza vaccine for their healthcare workers. Our hospital's one of them. Susan Coffin leads that program at our hospital, and so what we did this past year was for seasonal flu, not the novel H1N1 vaccine, because we weren't sure we could get enough in time. But what we did was we mandated it. We said that all of our employees, which is about 9,600 people, and not just our healthcare workers, but anyone who could potentially walk on the floor of our hospital, where there are vulnerable children, that they had to get a flu vaccine. And if they didn't get the flu vaccine, then they had 2 weeks of unpaid leave to think about it. And if they still didn't get the flu vaccine, they were fired. And so of the 9,600 people in our hospital, nine of them chose to leave the hospital. And so we went basically from immunization rates in 2000 of about 35% to an immunization rate this past year of 99.9%, because we didn't think it was okay that an individual could say, I don't believe in the influenza vaccine, and then walk into the room of a child who had cancer and potentially infect them. We didn't feel it was that person's right. I think what you're also seeing, and I think this is very hard for pediatricians, and I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to this, but I think you're starting to see a number of doctors, certainly in the suburban Philadelphia community, who are choosing not to see unvaccinated patients in their practice. Because to them, what they're being asked to do, frankly, is practice substandard care. And, you know, we've had three deaths, for example, of Hib in the Philadelphia area, and it's very hard for a pediatrician to say, you know, that I'm not going to give you the Hib vaccine because of a personal belief that you have, and then send the child into an area where they could get Hib. I think that asks too much of the doctor, and in some ways it's sent, when one continues to see a patient who's choosing to delay vaccines, you're sending a tacit message that you do agree with that, and although I think there's not a clear right or wrong to that. I certainly can see the doctor's point of view when they have said, you know, this is it. It means so much to me to vaccinate your child. Let me love your child. Don't put me in a position where I have to practice substandard care and potentially hurt them. I can't do it. The last point I want to make, and then I'll turn it over to Saad, is is that, you're starting to also hear, I think that, you know, certainly public health officials or hospital administrators in our hospital, like Susan Coffin, who's the head of our infection control program, or doctors, I mean, we can certainly send a strong message that vaccines are important to us and important to your child. But I think that the changes may only come, I think, when parents start to stand up. And you're definitely starting to see that. I don't know if you saw Stephanie Tatel is the mother of a child with leukemia, who wrote an excellent piece on Slate.com talking about her difficulty getting her leukemic unvaccinated child, finding a child care center for him, because there were so many children that were unvaccinated in the child care centers in her area. Selena Yarkin is a woman who lives on Vashon Island off the coast of Washington State, where there actually are fairly low immunization rates. She's the parent of three young children. She's upset that there are low immunization rates there, and she's now sort of started this educational campaign in elementary schools and high schools and health clinics to try and tell her fellow parents that this isn't okay. And then lastly, Brenda Lee Flint, whose daughter's name is Juliana Flint, this is one of the children in Minnesota who got Hib meningitis, even though she'd been fully vaccinated. Her parent, Brenda Lee, believed in vaccines. What she didn't realize was that her daughter had a B-cell immunodeficiency and couldn't make antibodies. So therefore, she really never made an antibody response to Hib and suffered severe meningitis. She's the mother now has testified in congressional hearings, and I'll stop with this. I think what is great that she says is she says in congressional hearings, it's not fair that Jenny McCarthy's voice should be louder than my daughter's. So thanks. I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention.